You mean to tell me two podcasts in one day? Yes, yes, yes. The reason why is because one of my very good friends I get to have on today for the second time. This man, the question that I asked this morning when I was reading through and I was looking at him was, why conform? And this guy has the answer to that question. And this is a question that we all talk about, like, why conform? Well, maybe it's because I can make more money. Maybe it's because I'll get to this level. Maybe it's because I'll get the promotion. Maybe it's because I'll get the girl. Maybe it's because I'll get the guy. But his question in why conform, he's not a guy who just asked the question, but he asked questions of you to be able to draw out the right answers. And it's incredible how he goes into this emotional source code, but also too, this man walks what he talks about. And there's very few people in the world that do this. I was at a convention a couple years ago. We were in the back and no one was watching. He pulls me aside and he just spoke life to me. And then he moved on, and it wasn't like he was looking for any credit. It wasn't like he was looking for any shine at all. He was just wanting to make sure that me as a person, I felt filled up at that time. And there's very few people in the world that are willing to do that unless they're getting a picture right afterwards, or there's a promotion, or there's a video afterwards. It is my honor to bring this young man on. Multiple books, we're going to be talking about them, solves challenges in companies, corporations on how to be able to communicate at a higher level and to be able to go to the emotional source code. Not only works with corporations, with companies, speaks it all over the world, but also probably he was telling me some of his favorite work is working with individuals because he goes deep and finds the root of the challenges. And so it's my honor and pleasure to bring on Mr. Dov Barron. So let's get this party started. Welcome to the show, Mr. Dov Barron.
Thank you, sir. What a pleasure and honor. I appreciate it. Always happy to have a convo with you, and really excited to serve. And I was just going to call you out on one particular lie you told, which is you said, this young man. I don't know what you're smoking, but it must be strong.
Hey, tell me about dying, man.
About?
Tell me about dying. Most people haven't ever died before. You died twice. Tell me about
five
dying.
Times.
Five times?
Five times, yeah.
Well, tell dying, me about dying.
Well, you know, there's this concept of dying, and you know, it's the and all the lights come on, and you know, God's waiting for you with his hand out, or Jesus or Buddha or some clown in a white outfit. I don't know. That was not my experience. That was not my experience at all.
There wasn't 12 dudes waiting for you and hanging out in robes and sandals.
No, there was no sandals. There was no robes. There was none of that. And it was very disappointing. It was very dark and pretty miserable. And I was quite terrified. And I can clearly remember fighting to get back to my body. Like, there's this sense of I was aware that my body was not where I was and that I was fighting to get back to that body and that I was fighting against something else that was looking to get to that body. And I remember that vividly, vividly. And at one particular occasion, I remember being in so much pain and so much suffering while I was in the hospital. And I know this from my daughter, who at the time was 14. And she was sitting there and she said, it was like in the movies, Dad. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, it suddenly went quiet. Like, it's a busy hospital. I'm in a public ward. And it's noisy. And then she said, it suddenly went quiet. Like the sound had been turned down. And she said, and it looked like a soft smoke was coming out of your chest. And she goes, and I knew you were going to go. And she said, I screamed, Dad, Dad, no. And she said, the smoke pulled back into me. And I opened my eyes and said, you know, sort of didn't say, but muttered, hey, sweetie. And I was back. And that was another occasion where I had passed.
So were you at this point that we hear a lot of times where you were being a bonehead and then you die, like you were explaining, and then you turn it around? I mean, or because for me, like when I have situations like that, in the moment, I'm like, God, if you get me through this, I'll do anything. And then like 10 minutes later, I'm like, nah, I'm good. I did, yeah, good. You know, I crossed my fingers behind my back. Did it change everything for you?
So, you know, the truth of the matter is that that's a question I'm asked all the time. Because I fell, as you know, I fell 120 feet while free climbing, got smashed to pieces and, quote, died. Did it change me? The answer is absolutely no. It did not change me. It embedded me. It embedded me deeper in my ego because before I fell, I wasn't a dickhead. I wasn't a horrible human being. I felt like I was a pretty decent human being. I was a good person. I was on a purpose and a mission, and I was trying my best to serve in the world. I was already a very quite famous speaker. I was traveling. I was writing. I was doing all kinds of good stuff. And that day, as I reached for that rock and that rock dislodged, I went tumbling down, and so did everything that was my reality. And if you'd have asked me 5 seconds before I fell, are you on purpose in your life, Dove? I would have said, absolutely. Ask anybody I'm working with. Ask anybody I'm helping. And they would have said, oh, you know, Dove's, you know, good stuff. And then after the fall, wired closed, my jaw's wired closed, and I'm talking like this. You know, all these bones are smashed to pieces. My face is gone. It's been reconstructed poorly, very poorly initially. And when people would say to me, how you doing? I'd say, I'm great. I'm coming back. I was more embedded in my ego because my identity was that I was this ghetto kid who'd been a boxer, who'd been a martial artist, who'd been a bodybuilder, who'd opened companies on 3 separate continents, who'd had all kinds of success, who'd done tough stuff that was not possible from where I was from. So to say that this fall is going to take me out would have just, it counted everything in my ego. So I embedded deeper until I didn't.
So give them the real side of like, okay, so you fall off the mountain. When you said, how many feet was it?
120.
Okay. How many stories is that?
11 stories.
11 stories.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in a 3-story building right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to fall off that.
No.
I mean, you could die falling 3 or 4 feet.
Okay.
Did you lose your breath?
Did you lose, like, because the 11 stories a long way. Halfway down, were you like, did you have to take a breath afterwards? Like, you were,
That's what everybody thinks.
No. Nothing.
So, nothing like that. So, I reach for this rock, grab the rock. The rock dislodges, and I begin to tumble. And I don't remember anything other than there was a jutted out area below me. And that hit me on the hip and flipped me around. So I was falling backwards. It hit me on the hip, flipped me around. And that's the last I remember until I woke up in the rocks with no face and blood everywhere.
Are you by yourself?
So I don't remember any of that. And I remember my buddy, because I had a free climbing buddy, he came scrambling back down towards me. And he thought I was dead. And for some reason, I said, again, don't know how I said it, because most of my mouth was destroyed. My jaw was in 5 separate pieces. And I said, move me. And he said, everything that he thinks about cognitively afterwards. He goes, why the hell would you move somebody who's done that? You wouldn't, like, because you could cripple them for life. And he literally scooped me up, picked me up, and moved me. And he moved me like 3 feet. And then the rock face crumbled and buried that area.
Oh, my God.
Where I'd just been laid.
So when you talked about it, you said you went deeper into the rough kid, I can do this thing, I can move through it. Why did that happen? Why do you think you went deeper into that? Because, I mean, it's a normal thing for us, right? Like, sure. we have adversity, and then we come up against adversity, and we're like, I'm just strong, and I'll just push through.
Yeah, because it's this bullshit idea that we have around resilience. So resilience is bad. Just in case you don't know, in case you're bragging about being resilient, which I used to do all the time, resilience is a bad thing. Resilience means you get knocked down 7, you get up 8. You might have even bragged about that. I know I used to. But what that means is you're just dumb. Why don't you stay down and work out why you're on your ass? That's a much better idea. Rather than going, I'll get up again. Hold on a second. Let me get up so you can knock me down again, which is what I was good at. Huh. I would just keep getting knocked down like one of those kids' toys, you know? And it was only when I got to understand that that wasn't working, because you don't want to be resilient. You want to be anti-fragile. And anti-fragility allows you to grow from the experience. So if you are watching this and you, like me, work out, you know you have to tear a muscle down in order for it to grow. It's the breaking down of something that doesn't make it resilient, because that would make it just go back to being the same. But it's an anti-fragile process that makes it grow and get better. It learns from the system. And I was not learning from the system. My ego was embedded in being that guy, that tough guy. So I was going to do that until the realization that that was not going to work. I wasn't able to do that. It wasn't ever going to bring me to whole. It was going to bring me back, but in life, there is no back. That's not how it works. Life evolves forward, not backward.
Wow. So even in the I sent you out the first rendering this morning, and we're going to talk about the emotional source code, which we're going to talk about. But I flipped it around because I was like, why conform? I mean, I'm thinking in my head, I have conformed to the resilient side. Like exactly what you said. And, but is there places where resilience can work?
Well, so first of all, let's just break it down a little bit, because as I said, that's an ego identity. And we'll talk about it more as we get into the emotional source code, but it's an ego identity. And so understand there's no criticism or judgment here. You have an ego, you, as in Kelly, as in Dove, as in all of us, we have an ego identity to protect us. It's how you survived. Your ego identity allowed you to survive. It's been designed to protect you. It's always been in place to do just that. It's not there for any other reason. And it is magnificent at protecting you. It was a really good thing. It was incredibly useful and valuable when you were a child. But if you're still running that ego identity and you're 30, 40, 50, 60 plus years old, then it becomes like, well, hold on a second. Is it time for a reevaluation? So there's nothing wrong with your ego identity. It was put in place to protect you, but it's worth reevaluating if it's relevant now. Because if you're still using the same ego identity as when you were 18 and you're now 45 and you're married, I guarantee you have some problems in your marriage. You don't have to tell me what they are. I already know you have problems.
No way. I mean, there's so many perfect marriages out there, Dov. You're saying that there's challenges in marriages?
No, there's not. I'm kidding. There's no marriages. No.
How does this? 97%
of marriages fail. Now people go, come on, that's wrong. I go, okay, let's just walk through it. Let's take a minute. Is that okay? We just take a minute and explain
this?
Let's go. All right. So if I ask you what's the divorce rate, you'll probably say 50%, because that's what most people say. In fact, that's actually an incorrect number. It's just under 50%. It's like 48. So you go, well, see, it's less than that. Hold on. So now let's go to second time marriages. What's the failure rate there? Because that number, 50%, is only based on the first marriage. What's the failure rate of second time marriages? What would you guess, Kelly?
56.
Very good. It's about 60. By the time, and it goes up by about 10% each level. So by the time you're on your fifth marriage, your failure rate is around 90%. 90+% of marriages fail if you've done marriages five times. Now, let's take that. Okay. So we go, okay, so the failure rate is much higher than 50. Okay. Now let's go this place. It doesn't include people who live together but never went through a ceremony, never got a piece of paper. Doesn't include those relationships. It also doesn't include the majority of marriages which are emotionally divorced. Mm. They still live together because they have kids or they have a house or financial commitments, but they're emotionally divorced from each other. So what we get down to is a failure rate of about 97%, because people are still behaving as if they are children protecting themselves. And so my defense mechanism is right. How do I know? It kept me alive. And your defense mechanism is right for you. How do you know? Because it kept you alive. And I'm fighting you to say mine is right, and you're fighting me to say mine is right. And that's the destruction of relationships right there.
So when you know this stuff, what are some of the things that you still struggle with? Because it's like the cobbler's shoes, right? The cobbler, you know, he's the guy with the holy shoes. So is there things that you still battle with?
So listen, the thing to understand is that when you do the work around your emotional source code and you get to your ego identity, you start to understand that, as I said, that the ego is not a bad thing. The ego protector is not a bad thing. It's moving it into the background. So it will always come up because it's been in place for so long. The idea is that you become actualized enough, awake enough, aware enough to say, no, thank you, not needed right now. So people ask me, well, how do you know when it's there? Well, you know, after all the years, Dove, and all the work you've done, surely yours is dead. And I'm like, listen, if you're trying to kill your ego, you are fighting a losing battle. It's not going to happen. There's a story about some bloke, you know, I think he worked for Abercrombie and Fitch. He had the abs and he had long hair and a robe. And he sat on the edge, not quite that way. He had the abs and he sat on the edge of a mountain, you know, and he was sitting next to this dark fella who was chatting to him and saying, you know, I'll give you all this. You can take all this stuff, all right? You just have to come with me. Well, think about that bloke as the ego for a minute, right? And that sense of being pulled into that offer is always there for all of us. It's being pulled into that all the time. So the question is not whether the ego is going to show up and make the offer. Of course it is. The question is, what am I going to do with that? And by the way, if you're going to try and use your willpower, you're going to be one of those terrible Sunday guys who got caught out for scamming everybody while preaching the gospel of, right? So definitely not. Like, so you've got to own that ego is not going to die. I want to embrace it. I want to see that it's there to protect me and see that it's going to come up with the offers that it thinks is appropriate to keep me alive in its context, which is not my context. So of course it comes up all the time. So it comes up, I'm with my wife and I'm like, she's lost the plot. She's clearly lost the plot. Now that's my ego talking. And I have to go, no, maybe not. Or I'm in a deal with somebody and I'm like, this person's completely loony. Like, how can they possibly see it this way? That's my ego defense mechanism. And it's going to be there. It's never going away. I've just got to embrace that's what's going to happen. Okay.
Can you talk to this about how this connects with siloed communication? I just came in touch with this word the other day, and I thought I was spelling it wrong. But I just got my PhD in Google. So I turn, and anytime I get in a conversation with somebody, I was talking to the guy, he's in the education space, And he started talking. He's like, the leadership is doing awesome. This mm-hmm. department's doing awesome, but they don't talk to each other. And I was like, oh, and he said, there's siloed communication. And I was like, oh, so I looked it up. And then it was like, that's a simple word. But when you're talking about the emotional side, can you talk to the siloed communication world out there?
Well, yeah. I mean, so as you know, I do a lot of work with corporations, and part of my work is breaking down the silos. Like, that's one of the reasons they bring me in. How do I break down the silos? Because people talk with, and instead of silos, let's just use this term tribe. Okay. Because human beings are tribal. Past history. We're still that way. It's in our genetic code. So we have our tribes, and these are the people we like to hang out with. Now, we often don't know why we like to hang out with our tribe, but everybody has a tribe. We are tribal by nature. Once you get that, you understand that you are going to pull people into you, and you're going to get pulled to people. And as a result of that, you're also going to push people away. There's a neurotransmitter in your brain called oxytocin. Oxytocin is called the bonding hormone, and it allows us to bond with people. It allows us to connect. When a mother breastfeeds a baby, there is a flood of oxytocin in the mother that goes into the baby. The baby then produces more of that oxytocin. When you make love to your partner, there's oxytocin. When you hold your kid or you pet your dog, all those things give oxytocin. It's this amazing bonding hormone. And by our interactions inside of the tribe, we get hits of dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin. There are other neurochemicals too, but those are the ones. Those make us bond to each other. Now, here's the challenge. Oxytocin is exactly the same hormone that keeps people separate. So people go, what do you mean? So let me give you an example. I want you to imagine, let's go back in history to the Second World War. And let's imagine that you're a German soldier working at the camp at Auschwitz. Okay? And your job, horrible idea, but just get it for a minute. Your job is to process people into the gas chambers. Men, women, and children. Horrible, horrible. Like, and as you and I think about that right now, we think, what a monster of a human being could do that as a job. Like, that's insane. And that guy comes home from work at the end of the day, and his wife is there and his two little kids. And his wife says, how was your day, dear? And he goes, it was good. You know, I had a good day. And she says, why? And he goes, well, I had a big, big agenda to fulfill today. The bosses gave me this big agenda. I got it all done. I got it done on time. And, you know, and she says, well, you're a good worker and you're a good man. And then he picks up his kids and he loves his kids and he kisses his kids and he kisses his wife. How is that possible? Is he some kind of psychopath who can compartmentalize? No, it's oxytocin. It's oxytocin. So the oxytocin that fired off in his brain allows him to be in his family unit, his family tribe, mm-hmm. is the same one that fires off when we are trained to other, O-T-H-E-R-E, other, when we other people. So this bipartisan polarization that we're seeing in the United States and in many places around the world today is feeding oxytocin. It's othering those people, them, right? Those people in Gaza, those people in Russia, those people in the Ukraine, those people coming over the border, those people in the Western states versus the Eastern states. All this is tribal behavior, and that tribal behavior allows us to fire off oxytocin so we feel good because we feel like we're part of something because we're tribal. And part of how we do that is by pushing others out. And what we have to do is to move into the tribe of humanity. Now, that doesn't mean that you should have open borders and all. People get excited and go, oh, this guy's a, you know, a new age ding-a-ling who belongs with the new world order. No, it's about humanity. And more than that, let's go further. Your dog, that crocodile, the bird that just passed you, and everybody of every color on the planet, we're all earthlings. We're all earthlings. What about the tribe of earthlings? What about a tribe of earthlings? Because, listen, whether you believe in climate change is man-made or not, it's none of my business. Believe whatever you want. It's absolutely fine. I have no problem with it. We can argue about how it happens. But the fact is, yeah, there's climate change. Okay. Now, but what we can actually look at is, as earthlings, are we taking care of Gaia? Are we taking care of this planet that we live on? Because if we're putting microplastics into the ocean and the fish are eating them and I'm eating the fish and I'm full of all these chemicals because of that, then, you know, I could do better. That's not up. It's nothing to do with whether I'm for drilling or against drilling. It's like I could be respectful of the planet that I'm on and I can be respectful of other human beings because I'm in the tribe of earthlings. So my brothers are Christian, my brothers are Jewish, my brothers are Muslim, brothers and sisters, I apologize, of all different faiths and all different colors. And I don't have to identify with any of them, but I can identify with all of them.
So when these tribes, mm-hmm. when you're talking about that you belong to the tribe, a lot of times the tribes create languages. And when I say this, in the siloed part, let's keep it on the business side of it for a second and then go into the relationship part. Yep. So on the business side, if you take like, say like the CFO or you take the finance department, they speak a certain language.
They do.
How? And then you take the CEO, that's the visionary. You take the CMO, which is the marketing officer, and they speak just how to be able to build the brand larger. You take the CTO or the CSO, right? And the technology officer or the strategy officer. They only speak those languages. How do you simplify and help people to understand the language of somebody else when all we want to speak is our own?
Right. So that's a really good point. So thank you for asking that. It's very well thought out. So the thing I would say to that is when I'm brought in, so I'm brought into these organizations, and I'm brought in for two main reasons. One, to help them build what we call a culture of belonging, which is a tribe. And the other is to help them to find their emotional source code purpose. So this emotional source code purpose is the unifying factor inside of this culture of belonging. So once I understand that, I don't have to agree with you, but I agree with this purpose. And so I will find a way to communicate with you, right? So I don't have to agree with my friend. I have a very good friend who was a Trumper. I am not a Trumper, right? And people go, I can hardly believe it. He's your friend. Why not? Why not? We've got so many other things that we have in common. And there's some common ground even in our disagreements. Because I know my purpose and I know his purpose. Because I helped him to get to it. Right? And so through the common ground, which is the connection between his purpose and my purpose, we can speak over all the stuff that psychologically shows up in the way. So it's this common purpose. Mm. Once we get that, everything comes together. So I'll give you an example. I was working with a company I didn't particularly want to work with. It was like, this is not particularly exciting. Right?
We won't name them. We won't name them and put their link in the bio. We won't do that.
But just to tell you, they were a national pipe manufacturing company. So, not particularly exciting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I had met the new CEO through another CEO that I'd worked with, and I worked with him and his company. So I worked with him privately and I'd worked with his company, and he recommended me to this new CEO. And he says, okay, we want to bring you in. I'm taking over as CEO and as a senior shareholder, and the old CEO is the founder. And so he's selling out to us and blah, blah, blah. Okay. And we're kind of in a disarray. All right, good. Well, you know, it's bloody pipes, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not exactly going, woo, this is going to be exciting. It's pipes. Right. So,
and you're bringing emotional stuff into a pipe company. I want you to know how much of a gangster you are, Dov, because for you to be able to do that and to see that how important these emotions are, even to the pipe companies of the world.
Yep. Well, it's so nuts and bolts, and people don't get it because they have this idea that these are soft skills. No, these are not soft skills. These are your hard bottom line. You just haven't recognized it. Mm. It will completely transform your bottom line. So we go in. It's a two-day training. We go in. I've got all the executives in the room, including the guy who is, you know, the old owner who's going to walk away. And he is a grumpy bastard. He does not want to be there. He's very, you know, he's a very blue collar, rough as guts kind of guy. And so I have no problem with that. I can get along with that. And I start talking to him and he's like, yeah, I don't really, you know, I don't know why I'm even doing this because I'm going to be leaving, blah, blah, blah. We work together collectively and I start my work on helping them, each of them individually, elicit their own emotional source code purpose. What is it that drives you as a human being that you've never even considered? So we do that work. At the end of day one, beginning of day two, we're going to now start finding the connection between each of those individuals who've been drawn together through a quantum field to create this company. And then we can really create a rock solid emotional source code purpose for the organization. Very exciting. At the beginning of day two, at like, we start at 8, it's like 8:30. Everybody's got coffee, they're sitting down. And this guy, Joe, says, I want to speak first. Sure, okay. He goes, I came in thinking this was a lot of old rot, and which is a very common response I get. I thought this was going to be some California woo-woo stuff. He goes, I came in thinking about that. He goes, and by the way, just so you know, and he looks at the new CEO, and he goes, I'm not selling you my shares. I'm staying on. He goes, you'll be the CEO. Your job's not gone, but I'm staying on because I now understand why I started this company. Wow. And I never knew that. He goes, 28 years, I never knew why I started this company. Now I know why I started this company, and I don't want to walk away because it is so tied to who I am at a soulful level. Wow. And this guy who's rough as guts has got tears in his eyes. And he walks up to one of the guys who's a salesman who he's been horrible with. I mean, I've watched him the day before be horrible with him. And he puts his arm around him and he says to him, I'm really sorry. He goes, you got it and I didn't. You're the head of sales. You got it and I didn't. And I just kept beating you up for numbers. And you kept telling me it's not about the numbers, that the numbers will come. He goes, now I see where you're at. Mm. That's just one example of how profound this work is because it's soulful. And when I use that word, people are like, oh, you know, we're going to get real. No, it's not religious. It's not woo-woo. It's connecting to the deepest part of your emotional source code and what it is that you've always wanted and what it is you've always wanted to give. When you connect to that, your life becomes deeply fulfilling and as a bonus becomes incredibly successful. That's why it's so powerful. I say to people all the time that I work with, you're already enormously successful. You don't need my help in being more successful. But what you do need my help with is being more fulfilled, more purposeful, more enriched at a soulful level while you do this. It's just a bonus that you'll become more successful.
What about when the one person in the company starts to feel that, right? And maybe the others aren't privy to the information. Because I think a lot of times, you know, a CEO will gain vision, right? That's what their job is. I got to have the vision for the company. And then they go in, but they don't know how to speak. My pop said this one time. He went into an interview and he sat down and the guy, he was a young kid right out of college. And my dad had been in the industry for about 30 years at this time. And the guy sat back in his chair and he got attitude and he crossed his arms and he was like, I speak three languages. How many do you speak? And my dad laid back in the chair, looked up in the air, and he was like, started counting on his fingers. And then he was like, probably like 60 or 70. And the guy got really offended, like puffed up. And he was like, 60 or 70? What languages do you speak? He said, I speak blue collar. I speak white collar. I speak minimum wage. How do you help a person, once they've become enlightened, to understand the language of other people? Because so many times it's just the language that's the barrier.
Yeah. And it's right back to what you started off in the beginning. As we climb that corporate ladder, and in fact, even as we climb the ladder from childhood to maturity, as we climb that corporate ladder, we abandon something that is so deeply valuable to us, and that is our curiosity. We trade curiosity for conformity. And when we trade curiosity for conformity, then we trade authenticity for approval. When those things take place, we stop being able to speak the language of others. So if you stay in, curiosity, you can speak the language of anybody. Mm. As I said, my friend is a Trumper. As you and I have talked about, many of my friends are very devout Christians. Many of my friends are Muslims. Many of my friends are Jews. Many of my friends are Hindu or Buddhist or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't matter to me. Why is that relevant? Is this all of who you are? So part of the conformity is, and the tribal thing is, we say, this is who I am. No, that's what I was doing before I fell and right after I fell. This is who I am. That's not who I am. That's a fraction of who I am. So you need to think of yourself as you watch this and listen to this. Think of yourself as a diamond. You're multifaceted. But you've lived in a world where you've said, what facet should I polish? And you've polished that facet and you've ignored the other facets. But when you start looking at the multiple facets, you start looking at the parts of yourself that you've blacked out in order to conform. Well, what if those parts of you that are blacked out are where the juice is, where the magnificence is? What if that's the parts of you that you can bring forward and transform people's lives with, including the life of your own life and the lives of those that you love? We've got to bring home those disenfranchised parts. But they went away not because they were bad, but because they're not part of the survival mechanism that the ego brought in place. So when you start interacting with people, you start to see people in this very unique way, which is everyone you meet is hurting. Everybody you meet is in some kind of pain. So instead of looking at them from this harsh judgment, I can look at them from, I see that you're in pain. I want to find out what that is and if there's something I can do to serve you, to assist you. Now, I will be clear, and this will sound harsh to some people. Some people want to stay in their pain. They're addicted to their pain. Okay. And that's hard, particularly if the person who is addicted to their pain is the person you love. Very difficult, very challenging. I have family members like that. There's nothing I can do. All I can do is stand solid on the ground of, I'm willing to love you. I'm willing to serve and assist you. I am not interested in saving you because that would disempower you. I'm not interested in that.
How do you know the difference? Like, how do you know when a person, what are the signs of a person being addicted to their pain as opposed to just crying out?
So it's very simple, but not necessarily easy. And simple meaning that you're asking for help, but what are you willing to do? When you ask for help, what are you willing to do? So when my brother wanted to move to Canada, and he called me and he said, will you help me? Now, my brother has had problems with drugs. He'd had problems with debt. He'd had problems with all kinds of things. And I said, no. And he goes, you won't help me? And I said, no, I'll help you. But no, I won't do it without you doing things. And he said, okay, what do you mean? I said, tell me the five biggest challenges you have right now. And he goes, well, I owe money to this person. I've got this going on. I've got that going on. Okay. When you come back to me with five things you've done to improve those things, you don't have to fix them, but you've actually taken active responsibility for these five things. You know, there was a deeper question, which is, where have you not taken responsibility for each of those things? So I said, once you take responsibility and tell me in an action you took, then I'll help you. Because then you're actually telling me you want to be served. You want to get better. Otherwise, what you're telling me is that you want to simply move your troubles to here. I'm not interested in helping you do that.
Help me to understand the difference between serving someone and saving someone? Because you just said that. I want to rewind. Like, when I say rewind to the young kids now, maybe you're scrubbing back. But I think of a rewind button because that was a bomb.
Right.
Tell me the difference between the two.
If I'm saving you, very simply, it's about me. It's my ego. It's my bragging rights. If I'm serving you, it's got nothing to do with me. I'm not into, like, it's got nothing to do with me.
That would hurt, Dov. That would hurt.
Yeah, I'm sure. I fell off the mountain, when I had to deal with that moment where I realized that I was fighting for my old identity, that was the realization. My bragging rights were about how many people I'd saved. You know? Jesus saves at the Bank of Montreal. That's my joke. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, keep your saving to the bank. Don't be trying to save other people. That there's nothing in that. It's all about you. It's all about your bragging rights. Serve them so they can save themselves. Serve people so they can save themselves. Let people come to the light of their own volition. Not because you said, oh, I can help you get along that path. And look at me, I'm this great guy. I did this and I saved that person. Hold on a second. Because that's all that is like, well, you're saying I took somebody away from the alcohol and look how great they were. You know, it's not my fault. I took them away from booze. I took them away from drugs and come live at my house. And I took care of them. And then they went back out on the street and they did drugs again. Yeah. Why not? That was all about you. It was all about your bragging rights. As opposed to simply saying, how can I serve you? Because you're in pain. And my service is not to change you. Not interested in trying to change any part of you. That's not my job. It's not my responsibility. I'm interested in showing you how you can see something in yourself you couldn't see before that's got nothing to do with me. Years ago, we were at a play for my son. When my son actually graduates tomorrow from police academy, he's in his late 30s. But when he was a teenager, we went to a play. And this lady came up to us afterwards. We didn't know her, but she knew my son. She knew my son and her daughter and him were in class together. And she said, oh, you're Michael's parents. And we're like, yeah. Oh, you've done such a wonderful job. He's such a wonderful guy. And he comes over and he's so respectful and he's so kind and he's so helpful. And I just looked at her and said, it's got nothing to do with us. And she said, what do you mean? You're his parents. And she goes, you know, you've obviously brought him up right. I said, yeah, maybe we did. And we certainly have tried to do that. But Michael's behavior is Michael's behavior. He's responsible for that. So if you want to give him a compliment, don't give it to me. Give it to him. Because by the way, if you'd have come up to me and told me my kid's an asshole, I would have said, go talk to him. That's his choice. He's old enough to choose for himself. It's not on me. It's got nothing to do with me. I can only lay the groundwork. I can only show the path, but I can't make you walk that path. And whether that's my client, whether that's my friend, whether that's my partner, or whether that's my child, I'm just going to lay the path for you to see, but I cannot make you walk on it. Because if I make you walk on it, then it's about me and it's about my bragging rights, about my ego, as opposed to being about serving you.
Wow. So how does a person... because this is a daily practice. I mean, this is a daily, weekly, monthly. This is minute by minute. Because I keep thinking about different areas. I mean, not that I'm guilty at all in everything that I've done in my life, Dov, which I am. Because you just shine the light, bro. Like, why you gotta do it like that, man? That was rough. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that people that are listening or watching, let that sink in for a second. I started going through every single time that I've thought that I was serving someone. But how does a person on the daily you know, exercise that muscle, because that's a muscle. That's a muscle, right?
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, I think if you'd have asked me 5 seconds before I fell, was I serving, I would have said yes. Because within the context of what I understood, I was. Within that context, I was serving. So if you'd have asked me 5 seconds before, are you before I fell, are you serving, Dov? Yes. Because I didn't understand the distinction between serving and saving. So what do I have to do is, and it's difficult, particularly with people you love, is because you want to help them, you want to guide them, you want to put them on the right path. You want to say, listen, son, daughter, wife, husband, friend, sibling, parent, you're off your rocker. This is not a good thing for you to do. Do something else. We all want to do that. There's nothing unnatural about that. But that's got nothing to do with them. That's my judgment of them. Many, many, many years ago, one of my great teachers was Parthasarathy. He was the dean of the Vedanta University out of Bombay. Bombay doesn't exist anymore. It's a different name. But that's how old I am. But Parthasarathy was talking to me one day. We were sitting on the on this sort of knoll in the university, and he's trying to explain to me about, like, I'm being very judgmental, right? And he stops me and he says, there are three things you'll need on the spiritual path. Now, I'm 23 at this time, and of course I know everything, because you do at 23. And he says, there are three things you're going to need on the path. And I said, okay, what's that? And he goes, number one, discernment. Well, at 23, I didn't even know what the word meant. So I was like, okay. So I'll crack on and pretend I know what it is, because I don't want to look stupid. So like, okay, yeah. The second thing you'll need on the path is discernment. Right. Well, if he says discernment for the third one, I'm dead in the water, right? Because I can't pretend anymore. So the third thing he says is, and more discernment. So I said, okay, so I'm not sure I understand what the word means. Truthfully, I had no clue. But I don't know what it means. So he starts to explain it to me. And I, in my arrogant 23-year-old, think, oh, yeah, he's Indian. He doesn't understand English so well, right? He speaks perfect English. He's a bloody professor at a university who gives lectures in English. But, you know, my ego is big enough to say, oh, you know, he doesn't get it. Because what I interrupt him and say, oh, you mean judgment. And he goes, no, no, no. Discernment. And I said, okay, then I don't understand. And he said, judgment is about them. Discernment is about you. If it's a comment about them that doesn't directly impact you, you're in judgment. You have every right to discern. And you will, and we know this psychologically, you will judge, but whether you go off on that judgment is a whole different thing. So you're going to walk down the street and you're going to see this guy who looks like he's homeless and overweight or drug addicted, and you're going to make the judgment. We all do it. The question is, do you live in that judgment? Are you letting that carry on in your brain, or do you go, none of my business? Now, when I say none of my business, that doesn't mean I have no compassion. It means that none of my business to judge. So what can I do instead? I can embrace curiosity. I wonder what this man's story is. I wonder what I don't know. I wonder what I could know. You and I talked about in the last interview we did about John, who used to be outside of my office, and he was the homeless guy, and I made my clients go and talk to him to find out, because they made up judgments about him, but they never knew his story. But when you find out that story, you move to a place of compassion rather than trying to save. I never tried to save John. I wasn't interested in trying to save John. But I know that I served him. And how did I serve him? By bringing him a cup of coffee and a sandwich occasionally, or giving him some food? Sure, but that's not service. How did I serve him? I sat down and listened to him. I sat on the edge of the curb with him and said, tell me about your life, man. Tell me about who you are. I never tried to fix him. I never tried to offer him any solutions. I never tried to do anything. I just gave him his dignity, which I don't have the right to give him, but had him validate his own dignity. Because we're so busy judging, or we're so busy feeling good, like, oh, aren't I a good person? I gave him $100. Shut up. How about you give dignity to people? Walk down the street and give dignity to people. When you walk past a homeless person, particularly today, there's so many, you have no idea what their story is. So you look away and you pretend they don't exist and you make them invisible so you don't have to deal with the shit that comes up for you. How about you look at them and say, how you doing? I don't always give homeless people money. I do give, but I don't always. But I always give them eye contact. And I give them the minimum is the brother nod. Right? But mostly I'll say, hey, how you doing? Right? And sometimes they say, you know, they don't even respond other than to say, can you spare some money? So most of the time the answer is no. But if we start having a chat and I go, how you doing? They go, oh, I'm okay, you know. And it's amazing the people I've met that way who are profoundly beautiful, who found themselves in horrendous situations. And, you know, we all know the saying, there but for the grace of God. Well, I believe in, you know, I do a lot of work around quantum physics and quantum fields. And when I look at that and I look at, I know where I came from and I know where I could have been. And there's a guy called Dave. And he lives in a parallel universe, and he's me as a he's the kid that I was who didn't leave, who didn't go and do the things, who adopted an English name in order to conform. And he's Dave, and he's overweight, and he's balding, and he's a miserable bastard, and he's angry, and he's pissed off. And I remember Dave in my mind. You know, you talked about the discipline. My discipline is Dave. I keep Dave right here. Something's happening. Oh, that's Dave. Dave's judging that. Not me, Dave. No, thanks, Dave. Not interested. Dave's, you know, the decision's coming up. Dave wants to go, oh, take the easy route. Be a slime ball. Or steal the spotlight. Right? Make it all about you. That's all Dave. Okay. And by the way, does Dave sometimes win? Yeah. Dave sometimes gets me. And I usually have to go back and apologize. It happens. Okay. Because I'm not... You know, I'm not all that in a bag of chips. I'm just a human being doing my best. So I fail, and I fail miserably and often. But what I have to do is surround myself with people who love me enough to call me out on that shit.
If my son rolled up on his bike right now, he's 12, mm-hmm. and he was like, hey, Dov, he would call you Uncle Dov. And he said, hey, Uncle Dov, you said quantum physics. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what it is? But notice that my son is 12, and mm-hmm. then he's going to be on his way real quick. And, yep. and he needs to explain it to the rest of his friends. How would you explain it?
So I would say it like this. The answer is when you think about things, i.e. this container in my hand, it's a physical item, right? That's called particle physics. It's physical things. It's traditional physics. It's physical things. In quantum, those when we look down the microscope, we observe those things. Sometimes they look like things, but other times they don't look like things. They look like waves. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Well, here's what's interesting. What's your son's name? I've forgotten. I apologize.
Maddox.
Maddox. So here's what's interesting, Maddox. Is what determines whether it is a wave or a thing, a particle, is what you decide when you're going in. So if I go in and go, I'm going to look down the microscope and I'm going to see a wave, I'll see a wave. And if you look down the microscope and you say, well, I'm going to see a particle, you'll see a particle. But we're looking at the same thing. How is that possible? That is called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in quantum physics. Now let me ask you, Maddox. When you look at your friend and you see an a-hole and I see an angel, who's right? That's quantum physics.
Do me a favor. Because he's just about to take off. Like, Maddox is just about to take off on his bike. He's like, thanks, Uncle Dov. Now I know what quantum physics is. Some people see their child as an angel, but I see him as an a-hole. That's quantum physics. Awesome. Uncle Dov, I have one more question for you before you take off. Or before I take off, because I'm on my bike and I need to get to my buddies and play some Fortnite. What is the emotional source code?
So the emotional source code is a little more complex, but the simplicity of it is this, right? The simplicity of it is this, that your computer only behaves the way that it's programmed. Sometimes you want to throw your computer through the window, right, Maddox? Yeah. Sometimes it's frustrating. It jams up. It does stuff that you don't want it to do, right? But it's only doing whatever its software allows it to do. And sometimes you have to strip out the old software and put in new software, a new program for it to run differently. Yeah. Now, what if instead you couldn't change the software? You could only change the software that goes on top of the original software. So that Dharma, that software that's in there as the foundation, is always going to try and have its influence, but you can do all kinds of things on top of it that allow you to live a healthy, happy, loving life in the software of your life. That's what the emotional source code is. Some of the programming you got kind of sucked. Some of it was great, but a majority of it really kind of sucked. And what we're doing is instead, we can't strip it out. We can't remove it because it's baked in. But we can make it jump through a bunch of filters. And when we make it through jump through a bunch of filters, it has to then choose. It has to look at it and go, oh, different than this. And by the way, Maddox, if you've ever used ChatGPT and you put in a crappy question, you get a crappy prompt, you get a crappy output. And you might go, well, ChatGPT's crap. Well, then how come it's not crap for everybody? Because it's about asking. It's the same program. Same program for me as it is for you, for it is for that person who's getting amazing results out of it. What's the difference? The quality of the prompt. The quality of the software information you're putting in over the top. That's what it is to understand how to use your emotional source code.
Wow. I want to bring this up. We were talking about it before. Let's see if it'll go. It's not. Oh, there it is. I want to show this because I was talking about all your books. Like, I was talking about your books. You've written like 80,000 books, I think it is. 79. Sorry. Well, maybe it's 79,000. 70,000. But this is why I was saying, like, with Dov, like, here, fiercely loyal, Purpose is missing piece, emotional intelligence. I can't even read them all because these are all the books that are available on his website. We've got it in the bio. You've got them. He's working on new books all the time. This guy is an absolute genius. And what I love about it though, Dov, is you actually relate to people. Like, there's some times where I'll talk to somebody and they'll be insanely intelligent like yourself, but they can't talk to people. Mm-hmm. And you have found that place where it's like the people are the most important is what I hear from you the whole time. Yeah. Like the people are the most important in that emotional connection with them. But what about the person that says, yeah, Dov, that's fluff. I need my bottom line ROI. I need my EBITDA to be high. And you're saying all this stuff. I'm not trying to get touchy-feely with my whole company because then everything's going to implode.
And my answer to that is, how do you know? How do you know that your company is going to implode if you get into what you're calling touchy-feely? Because clearly you've been avoiding it. So the truth of the matter is you've made shit up. You've made up what it's going to do. I've got research, I've got background, I've got case studies to show that that's actually not the case. But I understand you're making shit up because that's what we do in life. That's what we all do, and that's because we have a bias, right? We all are carrying our own bias around, and we're looking at life through our biases, right? So, you know, years ago I had a friend who said, we were in the gym. He was my training partner in the gym. And this guy walks in And I knew him, and I sort of gave him the nod, and how you doing? And my mate Mike says, who's that? And I said, told him who it was, and he goes, he's a loony. And I go, oh, you know him? Like, what do you mean he's a loony? And he goes, I can tell he's a loony. I said, why do you think he's crazy? He said, I can just see he's a mad bastard. And I'm like, why do you say that? And he said, he's a redhead. They're all crazy. And I'm like, what? I don't understand, Mike. Why are you saying that? He goes, they are. Tell me a redhead is not crazy. I go, him. He's a good guy. I know him well. Now, he had a bias towards seeing that because he was abused as a child by a redhead.
Mm.
Now, he didn't know that at that time, that that was his bias or where that bias was coming from. He knew he'd been abused, but he hadn't tied that to his bias. So all of us have our bias, and we have good reasons for our bias. And when I say good reasons, they're very good reasons for you. Your bias is in place for a good reason. It helped you to survive. So, for instance, Mike, as a kid, getting abused by a redhead meant stay clear of redheads. His ego mind went, hey, I'm going to protect you. Let's get the hell away from these people. But the problem is it's a generalization, and biases are always generalizations. So we go, oh, come on. This guy's from California, and he's got dreadlocks. Clearly, this guy's got all the depth of a saucer of milk, right? What does he know, right? He's got nothing to say. He doesn't understand anything about business. He doesn't understand anything about people. How can he? He wears a big ass hat like he's, you know, he thinks he's a rapper. He's got a 1950s microphone and dreadlocks. What is he like? He's trying to play kid. Like it's ridiculous. All that's biases. And then I said, well, why don't you sit down with Kelly and have a conversation? Have a conversation with him, man. I've sat down with him. Have a conversation with him. Find out what's going on at a heart and soul level with him. What matters to him? What drives him? How does he feel about his kids? What breaks his heart? What broke his heart? What opened him up? What shuts him down? What's the most loving thing that ever happened to him? What's the most painful thing that ever happened? Oh, suddenly we're all past the dreadlocks and the West Coast and the hat or any of those things. We're suddenly now into the human. So part of our greatest challenge, and this is the work that I do around building cultures of belonging, is learning those multiple languages like your dad talked about. How can I learn to speak this language? There's a company I'm working with right now. They've got a Ukrainian girl working there. Like, so these are top people, right? A Ukrainian girl, a Russian girl, right? And they both speak Russian, but a Ukrainian girl, Russian girl, two Asian people from different countries in Asia, a gay guy, and then the three other partners are all white. They all speak very different languages. I mean, all of them, including the white guys, very different languages. They all have very different emotional source codes. They're all approaching life from a very different place. But in 5 minutes of a conflict, I can have this person, so person A, see person B from a completely different way by simply moving them into their world. Wow. But we hold on to our bias, and so we're not willing to move into their world. We're not willing to see people from their world. But remember, everybody's looking out on the world through their own lenses, through their own history, through their own emotional source code. Mm. And that's given them the filters by which to see it. So like Mike, all redheads are crazy. Well, that's the filter. That's not the truth. But if you don't know it's a filter, you hold it as a truth. That's what we do.
What about from the framing side of the, let's look at it from the other side, where my pops told me a story one time. A guy walks out on stage. He has grease underneath his fingernails, grease up underneath his toenails. He has overalls on. They're cut up to his calves. He walks out. He has a galvanized steel bucket, dips his dirty hand in the bucket. It's got chocolate pudding in it. Grabs a hold of the pudding, slops it onto a paper plate in front of the crowd of 1,000 and says, who would like some? Nobody comes. Same dude, same pudding, but he's in a tuxedo. He has a crystal goblet. He has a sterling silver spoon, scoops it into another smaller little crystal goblet and says, who would like some? Everyone lines up. How do you, when we think about it from that way, sometimes people are so set in, well, everyone else should understand. Like when you said, like, you know, having the hat on, if you're watching, you see it. It's not for Kansas City. It's for Kelly Cardenas. That's, and it's for the Kansas City Monarchs, not the Chiefs. I'm not a fan. But when you say that, like the dreadlocks or the hat or the hip hop or the 50s microphone or all those things, how do we know when to switch that up based off the audience? Or do we just stay ourselves and allow people to come to us?
So we're back to that question around conformity. And so the opposite of conformity is traditionally thought of as authenticity. I have a challenge with that because authenticity is kind of one of those words that is thrown around, right? So this is an authentic pen that I'm holding up, right? It is a pen. It's an authentic pen. Well, what does that mean? Everything's authentic. A knockoff is an authentic knockoff, right?
Preach right now, because right, this word, nobody wants to go to it. But,
right.
And they don't want to call it for what it is, but people constantly just yelling out, you need to walk in your authentic self. Shut up.
It's just nonsense, right? And it's like these people who are online, who are political people, and they say, you know, well, I'm just being authentic. No, you're not. You're being an ass. You're being an ass, and it's okay. Like, admit you're being an ass. Like, you're authentically an asshole, right? That's what you are. That is authentic. You're absolutely right. There's a great deal of difference between that and honoring who you are, and honoring who I am. So I want to honor you in being who you are, because I have to honor that who I'm seeing is not who is in front of me. Who I'm seeing is nothing more than a list, an itinerary of my own biases. So I'm not seeing a white guy with dreadlocks. That's my itinerary. That's just my judgments, and you can take that same list and say, well, that's my authentic self, and I can say, okay, it doesn't matter what you say about authenticity. Authenticity doesn't exist on the external. It doesn't even exist in the words. It exists in the emotional source code purpose. Are you fulfilling your purpose? Are you walking towards the service of what it is you needed and what it is you've got to give? That's it. That's it. So I was very authentic before I fell, but was it real? Was I in service? No. So was I authentic? Yeah. I called myself authentic because I had big earrings and I swore a lot. Now, I still have nothing against earrings, and I still certainly have nothing against swearing. But that's not my authenticity. Those are affects of my authenticity. Mm. Everything is an affect rather than this is my soul calling out to your soul.
Where are you being challenged right now?
I find that funny because, like, where am I not being challenged?
Where are you being challenged and you're struggling with it? You know what I'm saying? Like the other day, I thought I had it. I gave an answer to a bunch of guys. I was like, look, we need to praise, like praise God. That's what my mom said to me. Praise God in all things. Praise unlocks blessing, and he's in the midst of the praise of his people. And I said that, and I was like, I meant it, and I felt it, and I knew it. And then I got in my truck, and I pushed the start, and the whole button fell into the dash. And I was like, I'm not trying to praise right now. You know what I'm saying? And then I tried to call a tow truck, Dov. And I tried to call a tow truck, and nobody would answer, and they were all mean. And I was like, I'm not going to praise right now. And then I realized the things that I just said, I'm being challenged with, and I'm actually struggling with.
Sure.
And so what are some of the things that maybe internally Dove is struggling with right now that maybe you hear, like, you know the right thing to do, but Dave keeps telling you to do something else?
Well, that's why I laughed, because I don't know that there's a moment I'm not being challenged. I'm being challenged. My wife and I, we've been married 27 years. We've both been married before. And we have a commitment in our marriage, and that is that divorce is always an option. And people go, that's terrible. And I'm like, no, it's fantastic. And they go, how can you say that? Because if I'm not treating her like she's the queen, she can leave.
Whoa.
I want divorce to always be an option because I want to be challenged in my marriage. I can't take my wife for granted. This magnificent human being has chosen to spend time with me. I am so blessed and honored to have her in my life that, yeah, I have to be challenged. And, you know, does she call me out? Hell yeah. Right? Just coming out of a session yesterday, and she says, I need to talk to you. And I said, well, I've just come out of a session. I'm not really grounded. Can you give me a minute? Yep. You know, we set some time, and she says, here's what happened. And she tells me, and I go, yeah, that was definitely Dave. Right? And here's my commitment of what I'm going to do. Not just I'm sorry, because that doesn't wash. Right? Who cares? What are you going to do? So I'm challenged every day. I'm challenged in my marriage. I'm challenged with my sons. I'll give you an example with my sons. One of my sons, I want to go over to his house and drag him out by the hair and slap him upside the head and say, listen, you're doing things here that are really not helping you. And as somebody who loves you, who wants the best for you, and who has seen your magnificence demonstrated, not just in my own eyes, but demonstrated, and I can see how far you are from that, I want to do that. And I'm challenged every day to just love him as he is. I'm just challenged to love him going through his shit, which is his journey. And, you know, I can tell myself positive thinking about, oh, he's going to, you know, one day he's going to awaken. I don't know that he is. My challenge is to just love him as he is. He's on his own journey. My challenge is to be a decent human being when I don't feel like being a decent human being. My challenge is to step up into a bigger game when my ego wants to, or my ego self, when Dave wants to say, you're not capable. You know, you and I were talking about before we went on the air that I'm speaking at a neuroscience conference in mid-March. And I'm at this neuroscience conference. I've been invited by the person who puts it together, who is a neuroscientist and a neurosurgeon. So he's, you know, he's a bit thick. Meaning that's a British term for stupid. It means it's sarcasm. He's incredibly smart man. And I have been to that conference before as a participant. And, you know, I've been to these lectures with the finest in neuroscience. But I have built a relationship with this man, and he invited me to come speak at this event. I get an invitation to go speak at a neuroscience event for neuroscientists. And in the profile I see that they've put up of me, it says Dov Baron MD. So I have to contact them. I'm not a medical doctor. Please take that off. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Should we just put the PhD? I'm not a PhD. Now, Dave's like, you're going to get there and you're going to look like a dick. All these PhDs and MDs are going to see through you. You know, Dave's giving me the chatter about how I'm an imposter and can't possibly do it. I'm challenged by that every day. But the question is, do I know my stuff? Yes. The question is, do I... Not by comparison do I know better than some of those people in the room. It's not by that. But do I know my stuff? Yes. Last time I was there, I was in a room with people, because part of what we do in this particular section is we're also talking about quantum physics. And there's a guy who's on a panel with me who I've interviewed on my show, on the Dov Baron show, that you can see behind me. And he's a quantum physicist. Out of a university in Canada and a university in Italy. He's a very bright man. Just wrote a book with Deepak Chopra called The Quantum Body. Amazing human being. Had deep philosophical quantum conversations with him. We're on a panel together. I saw him speak last time, And he was bringing up research as cutting edge that I was using 15 years ago in my presentations. My ego will tell me, because I don't have the piece of paper, that I'm not qualified. But what's the only qualification that counts? Impact. That's it. That's the only qualification that counts. And how do I have impact? I learn to speak your language, and I love you in it.
If you could take that mic and drop it, it would be awesome. Just pow. Dov, you know why I started the podcast, because my two kids, Maddox and McKenna, and I wanted to take iconic people like yourself, then, and I wanted to help them not to worship idols, but just be inspired by icons. And to have an Uncle Dov now is so amazing, because for me, gaining a friend, especially in the world that we're in the keynote speaking world and that world, a lot of times it's very siloed, like we talked about earlier. It's very siloed because a lot of people are like, oh, I got to perform and I got to do this because I've got to get hired back again, or I got to come back and they got to love me. And what was amazing about it is your spirit was building everyone else up, and you were completely okay, because if that company or corporation or conference wanted you back, they were going to bring you back. But you made it your, like, it was almost a mission. I watched you where you wanted to build everybody else up. And to me, that's the reason why you're iconic. Not because, you know, you've spoke at this conference or you're working with this person or that company. It's because of the way that you make people feel, man. Your vibe is unbelievable. What advice would you have for Maddox and McKenna? And if you could call yourself Uncle Dov, it would be awesome.
My advice would be very simple. Maddox, McKenna, always remember that everybody you meet is in some kind of pain. And if you can remember that, you can listen to them with compassion, even when they're behaving in ways that are just dickish. And yes, I would say dickish to your kids. Remember, everybody's in pain. And ask yourself, how can I serve this person? Not fix them. Not your job to fix them. How can I serve this person? What can I do to make this person's life a little more joyous? How can I bring a little more love, a little more dignity into this person's life? Not try and convert them into your faith. Not try and tell them what you think is right. You know, I'm gonna help them by bringing them to Jesus. No, you're not. That's all about you. I'm gonna help them by bringing them to the Quran. No, you're not. That's all about you. I'm gonna help them by having them understand this communication skill. No, you're not. That's all about you. How can I serve them and bring them to a little more dignity? If you can approach your life and everybody you meet from that place of recognizing that everybody's in pain, find out what that pain is and find out how you can ease that pain, that will change everything. But what I will say to you, as you listen to me, kids, as Uncle Dov's talking to you, is go home and take out a piece of paper and a journal, or write on your computer, or however you want to do it, and ask yourself this profound question. And you don't have to tell your dad and you don't have to tell your mom, but you do have to tell yourself, what is it that I wanted that I couldn't get or couldn't get enough of in my early childhood, even up to now? What is it that I've wanted that I couldn't get or couldn't get enough of? You might have got it, but you might not have got enough of it. And as you write that, your ego is going to go, I've got good parents, and you're going to want to get defensive. Nobody's saying you don't have great parents. Parents are wonderful. That's great. But as a human being, all of us have needs that are not met. And when you meet somebody who's in pain, that's because that need wasn't met in them. And by doing this exercise for yourself, you'll develop much deeper compassion for other people. Now your mind will say, but listen, I've got a good life and I'm not homeless and my parents are going to go. When nobody's changing that. We're not taking that away. We're not saying that's not true. We're saying that there's something you didn't get that you needed or didn't get enough of. You might have had wonderful parents, but when you understand that, you can also then look at your parents and go, they did a great job, but they didn't give me this thing. Now, there are many other people whose parents didn't do such a great job, and they're missing a lot more than you. You can have compassion for that and empathy for that, and you can look at how you can give dignity back to that person. Not give it from you to them, but give it so that they can access it within themselves. Nobody's better than anybody else. You have things, gifts that are just magnificent that you need to share with the world. The world needs you to be in your magnificence, but you're no more magnificent than anybody else. But it is your responsibility to step into that magnificence so that you can serve in a way that no one else can, because you are absolutely unique. You are the only you in the world. Not the way you dress, not the way you talk, not the way you look. You, your heart and soul is unique. And there is gifts in that. And when you embrace that, you become a gift to the world. You are a gift from the creative force of the universe. Call it what you like. But when you actually get in touch with that, you become a gift to the world. That's what I would say to you guys.
I have the greatest friends in the world. People say to me, you know, they'll ask, like, how do you get to know these amazing, amazing people? I honestly, I'm so fortunate because I have the greatest friends in the world, and it frees me to not have to be good at anything, Dov. It is so awesome. And for those of you out there who own a business or that you're inside of a corporate, whatever it is, I want you to realize that you just listen to the future of business. You just listen to what business is going to become. And if you don't understand it or you're pushing away from it, this is going to become the norm. And the more and more that, Dov, like, we need your voice more, man. We need your voice. And I know it's not, like, putting the emphasis just on Dov, but for people to understand that it's okay to communicate with people and it's okay for them to believe whatever they want to believe, and you just love them right where they're at, man. It's my hat's off. Like, and I was thinking, the last time I had you on, my mind was blown. And I was like, how is he going to blow my mind today? But I believe in Dov, and you blew it again, man. It is my honor, my pleasure to force you to be my friend for the rest of your life, man.
Well, thanks, mate. I really appreciate it. You know, I think it's really important for us to realize with everyone we're meeting is not given permission to be fully present. And that's part of it, is if you want to talk about authenticity, give people permission to be really present. And how do you do that? Well, you have to be present. You have to be really present. You know, how many times we've all heard the story, like we hear all these conspiracies around the Clintons and all the rest of it, but we've all heard the story of people who've met Bill Clinton. Everyone I know somebody who has either met Bill Clinton or they've met somebody who's met Bill Clinton. And they all say the same thing. He makes you feel like you're the only person in the room. Now, you can like him or not like him. I have a friend, his wife, hardcore Republicans, and they met Bill Clinton at a dinner, and at the end of it, she said, she's a hardcore Republican, she goes, I would have voted for him. Because I was the only person in the room.
Wow.
That is a masterful skill.
Yeah.
Being present with somebody so they can be present with you. And here's the thing. We are in the age of AI. Everybody's talking about AI. Everybody's worried about ChatGPT and AI taking over and blah, blah, blah. You know, you just said what we've talked about is the future of business. It's the future of business because of AI.
Yep.
People go, well, won't all this not matter with AI? No, it will matter more. Mm-hmm. More than ever. Your people will have to know that you care about them at an emotional source code level, that you give a shit about who they are and what's going on in their lives at a deep level, because everything will be so AI that relationships become more valuable, not less.
Wow.
So I'm doing a lot of work with companies who are really integrating a lot of AI, and they're going, oh my God. First of all, it's helped us with how to prompt the AI. Because they're learning the emotional intelligence communication. But aside from that, they're realizing that the quality of the relationships has to go up, not down. So you're right. It's the future of business. And that's why I work with companies. That's why I work with high-level individuals. That's what we talk about on the Dov Barron Show. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like understanding it's a quantum field. You're living in a quantum field. That quantum field is interacting with all other quantum fields. You're carrying your own emotional source code, and with it, your biases. Everybody who's turning up in your life is part of your field. We acknowledge that by saying mirror philosophy. What does that mean? It means everybody you interact with is a reflection of you. They're in your field because they couldn't be in your field if it wasn't part of your frequency modulation. Okay. So now instead of judging them, I have to look in the mirror. Okay. What am I seeing that I don't like, that I need to go home and look in the mirror about? There's so much in here that when you start looking at your culture, which is your tribe, and you go, oh, this is my tribe. This is my quantum field. This is my resonance. Woo, I better look at me. When I do that, I'm going to have to make some changes. Well, I'll just get rid of them. Then that way I won't have to do any work. Okay, good luck with that.
I want to go back to the Bill Clinton thing, man, because when you were saying that, like, a parent will see their kid as an angel and Maddox would see him as an a-hole, and I want to go back to that because my interaction with Bill Clinton was only one time, and it was in Las Vegas, and it was at the town center, and we were walking. And Bill Clinton sure made my wife feel like she was the only woman in the room, because he stopped and was checking my wife out, and I about punched that old dude. So, but he had the Secret Service behind him, and he was walking. He was old and frail. I probably would have not. I mean, I'm not a fighter, but I would have knocked him out. But it's funny because he stopped and he just like locked in. So he made my wife feel like she was the only person on earth that day too. So thank you, Bill Clinton, for staying consistent.
I know men he's done it with too, so I think you're absolutely right. He definitely has a preference towards doing it for women, but he does it with men too.
Yeah.
And it's not just him. It's often these very, you know, it's people you don't necessarily like, and you're like, you know, like John Travolta also has that thing.
Yeah.
Like I know guys who've met John Travolta, and they're like you're in the room with him, man. You're the only person in the room.
It's awesome.
It's like locked in on you, and it's like there's nothing else in the world. What I mean, that, and it's because, here's the thing, at a psychological level, human beings, we all want to feel important. And in this world of distraction, if you can make the person who works for you feel important, like you're actually listening and you're not checking your watch and you're not checking your phone and you're not thinking about the time, but you're actually there with them, that half an hour dreaded conversation you have will turn into 15 minutes. It will cut down by half, and that person will be so present with you and so grateful, and they will want to turn up the quality of the work they do.
Wow. Dov, you have been amazing, man. I can't wait for episode 3. I can't wait to hang out more, though. I need to see you. I want to see you.
Thank you, sir.
I would love to get you at some point to the Vibe Room, too. It's you saw the commercial at the beginning. It's a live version of the podcast, and there's going to be so many people that want to meet Dov. Anyway, I mean, after listening to this, if this is the first time you've come in contact with Dov, go back and listen to the first. But also, he's got one of the top rated podcasts on Apple Podcasts. This guy, his show is unbelievable, and you need to check out. If it's like the world can't get enough of you. We got 70,000 books. 70,001 is just about to come out. So I've got all the links. I've got the links for the show, the links for the social. More Dov in your life, the better off you'll be. But Dov, it has been an absolute pleasure. You're better than ever advertised. And I'm so thankful that you're my friend, buddy.
Well, it's very kind of you, Kelly. Thank you so much for having me on. Again, it's always a pleasure and honor speaking with you, mate. I'm honored to call you a friend. Thank you.
Dav, you're officially off the hot seat.